I am a former wokey. I'm a former leftist. Yes, correct. Okay. We are all already there. There is no avoiding this. And it will end in death and misery. There is no other end to this unless we change, unless we find another path. This will end in misery and then death. I can try to encourage people to be braver, to confront this more, to speak more publicly. I know how difficult it is.
Is there such a thing as the woke mind virus? Are we living in the upside down? Don't you find yourself observing human behavior at this time and think, what on earth is going on? Why have things like hyper-emotionalization, entitlement, victimhood become so pervasive? And not just pervasive, how have they become normalized? Certain behaviors within our kind of political class, our social class, the media class, have become, you know, these vastly unhealthy, what I would call unhealthy behaviors, have become widespread and normalized and even celebrated in certain cultures. So I really wanted to get a grips of this. I know it can be a controversial subject, but I discovered Josh Slocum, who's the host of the Disaffected podcast, and he's been dissecting this substantially now for a period of time. And when I heard his work, I thought, this guy really knows what he's talking about. He really can shine a light on some of these behaviors and has real firsthand insight in terms of how this can proliferate. So Josh, I'm just so keen to get into this conversation and learn. But you know, the premise behind your show is the abusive psychology behind, you know, domestic abuse and child abuse and so forth. But you kind of describe that these behaviors have gone public and feral, and that, you know, through your show, you're examining this through multiple lenses. What inspired you to start looking at this subject yourself?
A personal crisis. I didn't expect to be where I am today. If you had told me when I was a younger man that I would end up where I am philosophically and politically, I wouldn't have believed you, and I probably would have been offended. But as as often happens for people, facing a personal crisis can radically alter your perspective, or it can tear down your prior perspective. So about 7 years ago, I faced a situation where I had to remove my mother from my life, both physically, legally, and financially, and emotionally. And this was the culmination of a very long time, a very long experience that I had lied to myself about and had not told the truth about to anyone else around me. Pardon me, you will be joined today by a cat. It is not possible for that to stop. So you won't get much commentary, but you will have cat visual input.
But bonus guest on today's show.
Yes, I know. Go over to the fireplace. In a nutshell, my siblings and I grew up in a very abusive household, psychologically and physically abusive household. And as many children who grow up in such households do, we did not see the world clearly. And for complicated reasons having to do with my mother's marriage, how our family life was structured, it was not something I was able to face until I had to face it, because it was in my life every day, that my mother has a severe personality disorder, and that she had been as abusive and more consistently so than the violent man that she married, who was her husband, who was the one that was obviously and noticeably abusive. And 7 years ago, when I was 41, I had to, I had brought my mother into a home that I bought. I bought a second home that I could not afford, to give her a place to live, because she was poor, and I had spent many, many years trying to make sure she wasn't homeless by paying off her back debts, negotiating with landlords. And I thought to myself, well, if I can solve the major problem of my mother's chronic poverty, as she's getting older, as the eldest, the care will fall to me, then the best way I can solve this problem is by giving her an affordable place to live. And within 2 years, it had become so unbearable that I was on the edge of what we colloquially call a nervous breakdown. And I had to wake up to who my mother really was and who she had always been. And I had to make a decision. And I made that decision and I put her out of my life. But what I did not expect was that waking up to what was psychologically wrong with my mother, what explained the reason that she was so exploitative and abusive, what I did not expect was to realize, as I think I did, that these same behaviors and psychological motivations were animating the excesses of the woke left. And when I began the show 3 years ago, I used to say that we are in an abusive relationship in the West with the woke left. And I no longer say that because so much of the woke left has now become mainstream received political opinion. It's become societally normalized. So in a nutshell, I think that the psychological disturbance that characterizes my mother also characterizes our society.
Was there a moment, and Josh, what a story. I mean, my goodness, you know, what you must have been through is just, you know, like unimaginable. I can't put myself in your shoes at all. You know, I just feel
good.
You know, just what you were explaining. It's just, I mean, there was the shock happening in my mind as you were experiencing this.
It's shocking. There are many people who have experienced this. My story is not unique. Thankfully, not the majority of people. But it's not a few either.
Maybe this is a way to explore it, but I can't help wonder, you know, what led to those behaviors and personality types. But I'm thinking of that on one hand, just because I really want to understand that. But on the other hand, I'm drawing out from what you've just said around the kind of social connection to this and how this has become a normalized behavior pattern in wider society. So I'm curious, like what triggers these types of behaviors? But before we get to that, I'm curious to know when did you notice the parallels between your experience with your mother and the wider society? You mentioned it began with kind of the woke left. You know, was there a kind of specific moment where you thought, oh my gosh, this is what's happening?
Was there a specific moment? No, there wasn't a eureka moment. It was gradual. It was faster in some periods than in others. But maybe a good way to explain this is to define what we're talking about when we talk about personality disorders. Sure. Because that's really the nub of this. Let me set the stage by trying to give people a couple of cultural touchstones that they might be able to use to recognize what I'm talking about. I realize now that I'm near 50. My cultural references are just constantly out of date, so I don't know where your audience is. But I use my personal story and my personal experience with my mother, which unfortunately is shared by many people in families like this, and unfortunately is, I believe, now is something that we are all getting a taste of in the West with our government and our media. there was a moment when I was trying to decide. I had brought my mother into my home. I gave her an affordable place to live. I went to extraordinary personal expense to arrange this. And within 2 years, the same level of screaming, emotional dysregulation, going from happy elation to furious anger and spittle-flecked screaming within the period of minutes, all of these things that I remembered from my childhood were now back, and they were in a home that I owned as an adult. And I was trying to figure out what is making my mother behave this way. I still hadn't told the truth to myself that this was not out of the ordinary behavior. This was, in fact, the woman I grew up with. Whole lot of denial for most of my life, which is common for people. And I reached for easy answers. Maybe she's got dementia. maybe she's developing Alzheimer's disease. So I tried to arrange for her to take a cognitive test, which, as you can imagine, did not go over very well. And I talked to my sister about this, and my sister, my younger sister, had lived and spent time with my mother for almost 20 years when I had moved away and had been distant except for holidays. And she said some magic words to me. She said, Josh, our mother does not have dementia. Our mother is a narcissist. Our mother has a cluster B personality disorder. And I think you need to acquaint yourself with those. So cluster B personality disorders. Personality disorders are a kind of mental illness that is not like what people are probably thinking of when they hear the term mental illness. Most of us bring to mind things like major depression, chronic anxiety, perhaps schizophrenia, mood disorders. Personality disorders are a little bit different. They are so deep and so pervasive. They are what they say on the tin. They are disorders of personality. This is personal. It is a description of who you are as a person, morally, character-wise, how you regulate or don't regulate your emotions, how you relate to other people. It is a pervasive, deep-seated, ingrained pattern of extraordinarily dysfunctional behavior to yourself and to other people that is unbearably toxic. It is not like the cloud of depression that may come over your friend Jane for a period of time, where it seems like who Jane is submerged under this dark cloud for a period. Now, of course, depression, anxiety, and all these other things can be part of and go along with personality disorders. They're not opposites, but it is not merely depression. And I say that advisedly, because as a depressive myself, there's nothing mere about it. But personality disorders are on a higher level. I talk about cluster B personality disorders, and that's the American classification. I think the international classification is Axis II disorders. There's, in the American system, there's cluster A, cluster B, and cluster C. I'm concerned only with cluster B. And it's called a cluster because ostensibly there are four personality disorders that fall under that cluster. They are borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, and antisocial personality disorder, which people know colloquially as sociopathy or psychopathy. So these are the disorders in that cluster. What binds them together? Why are they clustered together? They're called the erratic and dramatic personality disorders. High emotion, high emotional instability, and they cluster around a fundamental narcissism, a self-centeredness that is so complete and so pervasive that it is difficult or impossible to relate to this person in a normal way, in a reciprocally loving way. People with cluster B personality disorders tend to be, and I'm speaking in broad generalizations, there's, you know, nothing will ever apply to every situation. I ask, my catchphrase is, I say to people, please supply your own, not alls. Supply your own caveats. Assume that I understand that they exist. I can't hit each of them. A fundamental narcissism that masks a deeply broken person, a person who does not have whole parts of their personality there. They tend to be exploitative, either emotionally, financially, physically, or all of the above. They do not take responsibility for their bad actions. They rarely, if ever, apologize when they are exploitative or hurtful. They very frequently see themselves as a victim of everyone else in the entire world. And most perversely, they often see themselves as a victim of the people that they have actually victimized. So in the parent-child relationship, for example, as a child, when my mother would lose her temper and scream and hit me, or make up a lie or try to convince me that something that I saw never actually happened, we call this gaslighting, right? I know these words are overused. I'm going to use a lot of words in this that are overused that people may have a reaction to. I understand that reaction. And I would say to people, please remember that despite their currently popular cultural overuse, that does not mean that these things are not real and don't exist. There is a place where they're correctly applicable. This is that place. What it came down to was when my sister said that to me, that our mother is a narcissist, I started to read voraciously and I started to acquaint myself with what personality disorders were. And I can only speak in cliches. Scales fell from my eyes. The light bulb turned on.
Yeah.
It all of it. And I mean this. I don't mean it in a cute way. I mean it in a literal way. As soon as I understood this, the whole back catalog of my life and my childhood started to slot itself as if it were a sorting machine in a factory. Things started going ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. Everything that didn't make sense, all my mother's inexplicable behaviors and moods, all of a sudden made sense to a degree because there was a taxonomy. I said, this is a known psychological state. It has always existed. There have always been these people. I did not know they existed, but like many kids from abusive homes, we think that our parents are uniquely crazy. You know, my mother is this way, or my father is this way. No one else would ever understand. I can't bring friends home because I'd never be able to explain it. Well, you can explain it, and they're not uniquely crazy. So I've gone a little far afield here. Let me give the example to give people what I'm talking about. If you are of a certain age, you will recognize these cultural references. If you want to know the kind of person, the kind of affect that my mother had and has, I don't speak to her any longer. She is a cross between Joan Crawford, the famous abusive mother actress portrayed in the movie Mommy Dearest, and the religious fanatic abusive mother in the horror movie Carrie from the 1970s.
And for the people who don't recognize those references, what does that mean in practical terms? You know, how would you describe the traits?
Right. I'll give one more reference. It's a little bit more modern. Tony Soprano's mother in the series The Sopranos is a classic example of borderline and narcissistic personality disorders. What are the traits? So I believe, and I no longer believe that there are four discrete disorders. In my view, most people, although some hew very closely to one, they may be more purely borderline, more purely narcissistic. Most of the people in that category have a helping of traits from each of the four allegedly separate disorders. Borderline personality disorder, I would characterize my mother as having strong traits of both borderline and narcissistic personality disorders. Borderline personality disorder is all about emotional instability, inability to regulate your own emotions, going from extreme highs to extreme lows in a very short period of time. It is not bipolar disorder. This is not manic depression. Almost everyone confuses these. They are not the same. I am not talking about that. And if people say, oh, you know, he's all over the place all the time, he's bipolar, they're confusing manic depression with potentially borderline personality disorder. extreme emotional instability, the core fear in a person with borderline personality disorder is the fear of abandonment. This usually comes from, where do these things come from? They come largely from child abuse themselves. It's a cycle that repeats itself. People with borderline personality disorder have a very difficult time keeping their emotions in check. They take their emotions out on other people to an extraordinary degree. Narcissistic personality disorder is a little bit more directly understandable. It's a excessive self-regard, believing that you are the center of the universe. And it's not necessarily, there are many different ways that pathological narcissism expresses itself. It's very easy to see. The easy ones to detect are the classic grandiose narcissists. So I would say, for example, a Donald Trump is a classic grandiose narcissist. Audience, I'm not making political judgments. I'm not saying who I'm voting for and who I'm voting against. Okay. I know this is difficult for us in 2024, but we have to try. Okay. So let me balance that out for you. Barack Obama, I believe, is the classic covert narcissist. It's a very different affect, isn't it? They're not the same person. Trump brags and says, I have the most beautiful women, the biggest cars, the biggest bank account. We can all see that. Nobody needs a degree to see that, right? It's easy. The braggart, the extreme braggart. The covert narcissist, on the other hand, and I would say Barack Obama is one, tends to be more urbane, more polished. He or she presents themselves as altruistic, and especially caring for community concerns and trustworthy. But that is also in the service of self-aggrandizement and gaining power over other people.
Okay, so from this, I want to kind of draw out, you know, as you were describing some of these things in this kind of context of the kind of woke left in particular, you know, and I appreciate you giving, you know, political examples, references the fact that these things don't happen just to one group of people.
No, they don't.
But I think, you know, to try and bring it to life for people, I mean, I'm almost picturing kind of people stood outside a Jordan Peterson event and screaming, you know.
Yes.
The kind of what's typically referred to as kind of the social justice warrior.
Yes.
Extremely emotional.
Yes.
But if I look broadly, more broadly in society, this kind of emotional instability, almost like hyper-emotionalization, almost just completely detachment from rationality and reason.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like the reason for the libs of TikTok existing is almost this personality type disorder that you're referring, which in a way kind of showcases these kind of behaviors. And I imagine people can reference that. So why is it that this group of people particularly exhibit these types of behaviors? Why do you and don't you reference yourself as previously belonging to such a group? Is that
would yes that be- yes I do, that's correct. Yes, I am a former wokey. I'm a former I'm a former leftist. Yes, correct.
Okay. So what is it that makes this group more susceptible to these patterns, do you think?
There are long-term societal, economic, and historical trends that are beyond my ability to fully describe that have brought us to the place that we're at. What I will say is I'm saying a couple of different things. One, yes, I am saying that I believe there is a greater percentage of the population who have full-blown cluster B personality disorders than there was in the past. So I am saying that, yes, a lot of the most prominent people, the screamers outside of Jordan Peterson, those kinds of people, I am saying that a vastly disproportionate number of them likely do have full-blown cluster B personality disorders. However, I am not saying that the majority of the population has a personality disorder, and I am also not saying that everyone who is on the left or even a majority of those on the left have a personality disorder. Instead, I am saying, if we take the analogy of, I analogize the family to society. In a family headed by a parent with a cluster B personality disorder, every child and every member of that family plays a role in cluster B rules, right? One child may be the scapegoat. The other child may be the praised golden child. The siblings are taught to work against each other in service of the egotistical father or the tyrannical mother. We are doing this at societal scale. So even the people, all of us, personality disordered and non-personality disordered, we are far more narcissistic and emotionally dysregulated as a population than we were 100 years ago. So that doesn't mean we all have personality disorders. The traits of these personality disorders are actually human psychological traits. Most of us, at some point or another in our lives, will experience and deploy some of these traits and behaviors. Not all of them, but most of them. They are part of being human. What makes this a disorder is the severity and the ingrained, the fact that they seem to be the controlling manner, the way a person carries himself across multiple domains to a degree that is unbearable to the rest of us. What is making this happen? I can't, in a sense, it sort of turtles all the way down. I don't know where to stop. I don't know where the level of explanation is that we need to stop at. But, you know, I'm certainly not the first person to notice this. I mean, I just this morning I was reading C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And this was written in the 1940s. And the things he's talking about are very familiar to modern audiences. Obsession with sex, obsession with appearance, obsession with self-gratification at the expense of moral commitment and follow-through. These are not new problems. But we somehow, and I don't know the answer to why, somehow our society in the West generally has elevated narcissistic and acquisitive traits and has normalized them socially to such a degree that behavior we would have been able to recognize as abusive, immoral, or unethical 100 years ago is considered normal today.
Do you think social media has played a role in this? You know,
it's yes.
Well known that, you know, kind of selfie culture is a reflection of that kind of narcissistic. There's almost a shallowness to that.
Absolutely. And let me actually answer the question that you asked me. You said, why is the left, why are these people on the extreme left more vulnerable to this? This will not be the case for everybody, but I think it's the case for a great number of them. And it was certainly the case for me. People who come from broken homes, divorce, neglectful parenting, abusive parenting, unstable family structures are far, far more vulnerable to developing these traits and then to being led by a Pied Piper, a political or cultural Pied Piper who promises a better world that we can remake. That is certainly a huge part of what drew me to the left and to eventually becoming a woke leftist. Without a solid foundation in stable relationships between parent and child, that in turn give a person a stable sense of self and purpose, when those things go wrong, we go astray and we start looking for an answer. And there's no end of narcissistic, self-aggrandizing alleged leaders who say that they have the answer, and if we follow their program and if we carry out their will, then we will be making the world a better place. And it leads to all sorts of destructive ideas. Just everything normal, everything sane, everything wholesome, if you will, is now culturally derided.
Yeah.
That's leftism. That is leftism.
It's kind of driven in the name of progress, and there's, you know, this, you know, leftism is kind of associated with kind of radical progressivism, and, you know, I'd say it would come, you know, some would argue it comes with a moral decline, but a moral dysregulation, you could almost say.
Yes.
But there's a element that's often commented on around, again, this, the entitlement, you know, it's the alongside a sense of injustice, which has been mobilized in a way that is often driven by a sense of victimhood.
Yes.
Which are patterns that are not unique to, but quite distinct to this kind of leftist, woke, social justice warrior personality type. I mean, I've looked at this from a couple of lenses, and I've oversimplified it in a massive way, but, you know, you can kind of look at, there are parallels between left politics and being associated with emotion. You've got right politics associated with logic or rationality. And that's not to say either is right or wrong. We all have all of those things, but patterns. Left more feminine energy, right more masculine energy. And again, generalization.
Yes.
But it feels like in the culture right now, you know, everything is sensationalized. Everything is like fear-based. We live in this kind of perma crisis, and everything's like, it's become hyper-emotionalized. And therefore, we become susceptible, like we did during COVID, where like the world almost lost its marbles because...
Not almost. This matters. This matters. We have to tell the truth about this.
Yes,
the world did in fact lose its mind.
Yes, I agree. My audience thoroughly know that I agree on that point. But again, it's like this disconnection between this kind of more rational approach to understanding something. And it seems like there's almost the two wings of the same bird. Emotion and logic have become so far alienated from one another that we have this extreme hyper-emotionalization that is just permeated society, but it's become normalized, because you're absolutely right. What you described, you know, is this leftism, it has really chipped away at those kind of moral bases of our society. And it's not to say that there aren't things that do need to be changed. You know, most of us would agree on that, no matter where you come on, sit on politically. But it's become so hyper-normalized now that there was a time where we could almost identify a certain type of psychological phenomenon within an individual. It'd be recognizable, some of the things you talked about earlier on. But now it's just become so normalized that where does the madness begin and where does it end? Because it's become accepted as a result of that normalization. Not only normalization, moralization. That's now the way to be.
Yes, the great. It's elevated. It is now called the good.
Yes. So, yeah. I mean, how do we orientate ourselves in this how does one orientate themselves in such a world? How do we break free from such patterns?
Well, the first thing we have to do is recognize the pattern and recognize what it is. Name it. See it for what it is. Right? And you are correct. We're hyper-emotional. Society has become feminized excessively. I'm not criticizing women, although, of course, as anyone knows who discusses these things, especially if you're a man, one will be called a misogynist in a very hyper-emotional way. But the masculine and the feminine are completely out of balance. Society has been thoroughly feminized and emotionalized. Emotion and rationality are supposed to exist in relationship and conversation with each other. They are to be in balance with each other. They are part of all of us, regardless of our sex. But we are out of balance right now. You see it in the family structure. The lack of fathers in homes. I can't say whether it's correlation or causation. Yes, I can. We are seeing the results of children growing up without a stable two-parent family. We're seeing it all over the place. It results in emotional dysregulation, aimlessness in life, going after frivolous pursuits, dangerous sexual and romantic practices, lack of fulfillment, lack of stability. I'm an example of this, and I use my example, because it's the best way I know to help people make the bridge between the personal and the larger societal issues. It'll be different for everybody, but I assume that in telling these stories the way I do, that most people can find an emotional analog in their own lives, even if their story is not like mine. So I had no father. I never met my father. He left before I was born. My mother, when I was a very young boy, married a violent man, terribly violent man, who was my stepfather. So I had no father, and the only father figure I had in the home was somebody who had severely beaten his children and tried to murder his wife in front of them. You don't get out of that psychologically whole. You don't. You get broken. And when I became a teenager, and I went down a really bad path, I was taken out of my home when I was 13 years old and put into basically a glorified orphanage, a group home institution for wayward boys, which is what happens to abused children. Their parents abuse them and the children go to jail while the parents get off scot-free. And I threw all of myself, all of my identity into being gay. You know, I came out as gay very young, at the age of 12 or 13 in the mid to late 80s, which was unusual in those days. And I paid a price for it. Of course, society was different then. I did experience actual bullying. I did get beat up. I had some problems as a result of this, but I incorrectly attributed the bulk of my unhappiness and my lack of direction in life to being gay. Everything was homophobia. Everyone was treating me badly because they hated gay people. If people weren't homophobes, then my life would be fine. That wasn't true. It doesn't excuse bullying behavior, but my problems were not all from that. My problems were from my childhood. They were from the way I was raised and what that had done to me emotionally and psychologically. And you see this in a lot of gay men. It leads to extraordinary promiscuity, both with sex and with drugs and alcohol. It leads to a very surface lifestyle that's about appearances, materialism, acquisitiveness, hedonism. I'm sorry, gay men, but you all know it's true. You all know that this is true. Give your not alls, right? It's not all, but you do know it's true. There's a reason for stereotypes. It's because they do accurately describe the way a population of people tends to behave, even if it's not 100%. So, you know, it was very easy. I became involved in activist politics as a teenager. I became a poster boy for a gay rights ordinance in the city that I grew up in. When I was fired from my job, and I was fired from my grocery store job because I was the victim of physical attacks. It was easier to get rid of the victim than it was to address the problem. I became the poster boy for a new ordinance in my city that said you cannot fire people on the grounds of sexuality. You can't hire and fire, and, you know, da da da. All fine and good as well as it goes, but I shouldn't have been a political activist on local television at 16 years old. That's not a place for a child. And I built my identity on this, and I sunk my emotion into it. And it just built from there. And I went, you know, I went, as many young people do, I went to a very liberal arts college, where I spent 4 years. I didn't realize it then, but I was basically being taught to be a Marxist, a revolutionary Marxist. It was all Foucault, Derrida, continental philosophy, destroy the power structure, destroy the patriarchy, decolonize everything. All this stuff we're dealing with today, this is not new. This is going on, and it wasn't new when I was there. I started college in 1995, but all of this stuff we're talking about today was all the curriculum then. And it wasn't new when I started.
I mean, that's new news to me. I've not spoken to anyone about the history of these things, and obviously
they go back a long, long time.
Okay, I mean, that's a fascinating point. I mean, there's a lot to unravel there, but the common connection here is this trauma or unresolved trauma. You know,
yes.
I'm sure your mother has her own story about her
yes.
trauma that's led to that, and you know, the behaviors that
yes.
she's had. So. What do you think is the connection between trauma or unresolved trauma and this kind of mainstreaming of victimhood or narcissism or entitlement or emotional dysregulation? Is there surely is a connection here?
It's a direct connection. It's direct.
In which case, are we dealing with kind of pervasive trauma? You know, is there a collective trauma that's kind of manifesting in this behavior? And why are we not able to identify what's driving that trauma? Because there is circumstantial trauma, which is, you know, the people who have been type through experiences like yourself, you can understand where that's come from. But and you correctly say that it's probably more concurrent than most people believe. But at the same time, you wouldn't necessarily expect that story to be common across the breadth of society. So we've got this situation where there is something driving this behavior, and trauma could be one of those things. But what is that collective trauma? And you know, how do we identify it?
My guesses about that are that for many people, particularly the most active, the most visible, and the most emotionally dysregulated on the left right now, statistically, probably most of them do have genuine traumatic backgrounds in childhood. Child abuse, neglect, but everybody's story isn't going to be as florid as mine is. And there are people out there who have much more dramatic abuse stories than what happened to me. It's a spectrum. It's a gradation, right? Even people who didn't have parents who would hit them, scream at them, lie to them, psychologically brainwash them, may still have unmet needs from childhood, a stable two-parent family, a mother or father who taught them how to emotionally regulate themselves, how to have a good sense of ego strength in the face of adversity without becoming overly self-aggrandizing. You know, just even a hands-off parental approach that doesn't instill those values can leave somebody very badly equipped for adulthood. And so you can imagine, you can see then easily how some of the most damaged people will become the lightning rods, the celebrities, the heads of political parties, the narcissists. And you can see how maybe those who didn't have quite the same experience but are still vulnerable to it will become their acolytes. And unfortunately, there's no shortage of people like that out there, because even, you know, I just look at the divorce rate. You know, in the Western world, in the United States, it's around 50%. You know, and in some demographics, in the Black community in America, for example, the majority of kids are growing up without a father in the house. This has consequences that we all see every single day on the street, in the grocery store, and on the news. We see it, even if we lie and say that we don't see it.
Well, Josh, there are some political commentators that are arguing that the leftist population are actually driving part of that destruction of the nuclear family. I mean, what extent do you think that is true?
Oh, I think it is true. It is true because I participated in it when I was a leftist. You know, I was one of those people who would say, the nuclear family is an oppressive structure. It's heteronormative. It's patriarchal. I didn't even know if I knew what I meant to be saying when I said those things. But I do know that I had a great deal of fear, anger, and resentment. I'm not saying I don't have fear and anger now. I certainly do. It's something I continue to have to work on. But those things that I didn't have, I decided that therefore they weren't worth having. And that everybody who said they were worth having was a patsy and a fool, and they were responsible for repressing and oppressing those of us who wanted to live a more bohemian lifestyle or wanted to love in a different way or do this, that, or the other thing. So yes, the left is very explicit about this. They do see the heterosexual nuclear family, which is, I can't believe I just said that. It's just what family is. This is the human organism. homosexuals out there, you are able to accept this too, even if it's not going to be your lot in life. You can accept that it's normative and normal.
I love your disclaimers. We should put these on the captions on the screen.
I'm constantly pre-defending what I say, it's pointless.
I live the same, because
someone
is going to say something. It's like, not talking about you. I'm talking about in general.
But it's very explicit. They say we have to dismantle these structures. We have to take the patriarchy away. We have to dethrone men. We have to dethrone fatherhood. We have to dethrone the idea that children need two parents. We need to dethrone the idea that they need a mother and a father. We've dethroned it to such a degree that we tolerate what I see as one of the most despicable and disgusting immoral practices, which is commercial surrogacy, buying children, deliberately creating children in a cash transaction, and then deliberately depriving that child of the relationship to his natural mother and his natural father. It is astonishing to me that this is now normalized. But this is the left. This is the left. Any freedom for the individual, satiating any desire, no matter how hedonistic, frivolous, excessive, no, satisfying that desire and satisfying it quickly is itself a moral good. So anything that stands in the way, that slows you down, that causes you to question yourself and say, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the morally right thing? Is what I'm doing going to have a terrible effect on this child or my partner? All of those questions are pushed to the side. Those are considered oppressive. That's the narcissism. Me, 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 me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm unraveling so much as you were speaking here. So there's the cultural factors, there's the social factors, there's the education system, you know, from what you're describing, it's an indoctrination system in a way.
And we didn't even get to primary school, elementary school. It starts way earlier. It starts way earlier. But yeah, the college system cements it.
But I suppose it's almost like there's a simmering that becomes a boil, and in a way, it's like you can't notice your hair growing, but it's growing every day. And you know, there's been a slow slide, I think, that's led to a kind of boiling point, which is now manifesting itself in what we're witnessing in the world.
Yes.
And the point around the male figure, I mean, this is something I'm interested in. My friend Rob Moore is actually flying out to Romania next week to speak to Andrew Tate on his show. And I would imagine he probably qualifies as one of those cluster person. I don't know how much you know about Andrew Tate, but I would imagine he qualifies as one of those personality types. But as a result, you get this kind of what I would describe as unhealthy masculine role model. But you can see it's a total response.
It's a response
dumbing down of the male, and you know, alongside the kind of liberation of the females, which is amazing and something to be celebrated. It feels like the male species has lost its way in a way. It no longer knows its role and purpose.
Yes.
And, you know, there's no surprises, you know, during COVID, the first people to have the courage to stand up against some of the things where people were losing their marbles was the women. Where were the men? You know, they weren't there at the beginning in general. They were some. Again, I'll do my disclaimer. I know you were there. I saw you. But there's almost like this erosion of what it means to be a man. And as a result, we now get these not necessarily healthy role models to counterbalance that. So if we look at things like emotion and rationality and how they intersect, and again, it's generalizations, but you know, if the female chromosome is generally more in touch with its emotions and the male species more in touch with the rationality, again, it's a holistic, I understand that's a gross oversimplification. But if we therefore then the masculine side is no longer providing that kind of counterbalance to emotion, then it's not surprising that we end up in this hyper-emotionalized state. So I see that as one variable, and I think it's an important variable, but there seems to be so many. And living in this digital world, this idea of social contagion, we were talking about Matthias Desmet's work before we started this interview, and you know, he talks about mass formation, which in a way is a description about how, you know, latent trauma or what he calls free-floating anxiety can lead to these social contagion patterns that lead to herd mentality. Do you think some of these things have become normalized because of this kind of social contagion, or even the patterns themselves, Josh? Do you think some of the patterns themselves are a function of social contagion?
Sure. I mean, social contagion is, social contagion is just another way of describing a thing that humans are prone to do. We are social creatures. We pick up on the emotions and thoughts of other people. We can be swept up in other people's hysterias. There's nothing unique about our era in that way, except the degree to which we have carried it. And certainly social media has made it almost impossible to avoid being caught up in these things. It is so unnatural. Humans did not evolve to relate to other people. We don't have the equipment. We literally are not programmed to successfully relate to our fellow humans through screens that have taken away all context, all body language, all tone of voice. All the artificial sense that we are close to a person who we have never experienced as anything but a collection of pixels. Quite literally, we see their picture, we see their words on Twitter. This is not normal human interaction, and it's deranging. And the social contagion is so out of control now. I mean, it's not, you know, in the 80s, some of the big examples of social contagion were anorexia and bulimia among young women. And young adolescent girls are, we all know this, are very, very prone to social contagion and mass emotional hysteria. That is simply a fact of the young adolescent female. It's not that no males are susceptible to it. They are. But this has always been the case. But it can spread so much more quickly and so much more pervasively now. Can you imagine how much worse the anorexia and bulimia problem of the 80s would have been had the internet been available? And, you know, people talked a lot 15, 20 years ago about what they called the pro-ana websites, pro-anorexia websites that were bunches of very sick girls giving each other tips on how to get skinnier and skinnier and glorifying and validating this illness. That was bad enough, but look what we have today. Look at trans. My God. My God. We are I'll just come out with the most controversial thing. Transgenderism is not real. There is no such thing as a transgender person. No person ever changes sex. That is not real any more than 2 + 2 = 5 is real. This is a modern obsession, and it seems very real to people, and people have very real emotional investment in it, but its claims about the universe and about humans are not true. They are delusions. And we have taken the most extreme form of self-harm. We've taken the most extreme form of self-harm when you go all the way to poisoning your body with exogenous hormones that lead to sterility, early onset osteoporosis, heart disease, early death, then slicing off healthy body parts, refashioning body parts into a simulacrum of something they can never be. This is extraordinarily sick. I'm not going to mince words about it, and I'm not going to caveat it. There's nothing to caveat. This is extreme trauma that is coming out and being reenacted every single time somebody takes up this identity. It is self-destruction. It is suicide. It is complete disconnection from reality. And what does our culture call this today? Beautiful, loving, self-actualizing. To a certain degree, the state of calling yourself transgender is itself, to me, one of the most obvious expressions of a borderline personality style. The lack of a sense of self, the lack of a sense of stable identity, complete disconnection from physical and social reality. Trauma-based, yes. Pain is underneath this. Real suffering and real pain. I'm not making fun of anybody at all.
There's almost an unwillingness to confront the difficult conversation around that trauma. That's, you know, when if you look beneath the surface, you can quite clearly see it's there. And it's this whole celebration of the LGBTQ culture, particularly focusing on the trans element, has really dwarfed all the rest of the letters in however many letters are in that acronym now. And as a result, you know, we can't have an adult conversation. Again, we're hyper-emotionalized around the conversation. We can't bring a rational discussion into it without resulting in ad hominem, very traumatizing experiences, which is disappointing because underneath all of the noise, there are people suffering and it's not being recognized.
Oh, yes.
And the field of psychology seems unwilling to...
The field of psychology has been perverted. I use this in the original sense of the term. I don't want people, please, to hear. I don't want them to hear overtones of sectarian religious moralizing. That is not what I mean. I mean, yeah, many religious people also feel this way. But to pervert is to turn from. That is what the word means. Perversion is to distort the truth, to turn away from the truth, to turn away from reality. Psychology has been perverted. Teaching has been perverted. Truth has been perverted. Another way of describing what I call cluster B, you can use many different names for this. You can call it cult thinking. You can call it totalitarian or authoritarian thinking. You can call it political extremism. We are all talking about the same fundamental psychological states, whatever label we put on them. But what characterizes the cluster B mindset, the narcissistic mindset, is the moral, it is the inversion of truth and the inversion of moral goodness. And I say that in the broadest possible sense, not a sectarian sense. But I must, because it can't be expressed better any other way. Isaiah 5:20 speaks to this. Woe unto him who substitutes bitter for sweet and darkness for light. You don't have to be a believing Christian to see the wisdom of that. You know, this is a true statement about the reality of humans. We have inverted the truth. We call abuse love. I mean, Dan, had I been a little boy in today's era, I would have been transed. And so many gay men like me that I knew would have been transed. Thank goodness that was not available, because it absolutely would have happened to me. My mother would have ensured it. She tried to ensure that it happened to another young member of my family.
I mean, it's culturally, I mean, I met someone recently. She's a student in one of the local universities. She's here as an exchange student. She's not from the UK. She arrived, you look at her social media when she arrived compared to where she is today. She arrived as kind of a beautiful, very feminine woman. But now she's part of this kind of culture, and she now dresses like a man. She's shaved her head off. Like, she hasn't gone as far as physically transitioning, but, you know, there's clearly social pressure for her to show up in a certain way. And again, you will see memes like this circulated on the internet, but this is true. You know, in all her original photos, she's very, very light. There's a happiness to her. There's a joy. And now you look at all of her photos, and there's this stress, there's this angst, there's trauma.
Yeah.
And you can't tell me that person is now happier because of the choices they're making. And again, it's that may be a representation, but I know so many stories within the kind of British education system that is creating this almost indoctrination that people need to conform to this type of behavior.
That's the inversion that I'm talking about. The truth is inverted. You know, you see this young woman, and you know, you can see that she's suffering, and but what do such people say? They're experiencing trans joy. This is joy. This is self-actualization. This is who I was meant to be. It is a complete inversion of the truth.
Yeah, well, it comes to the point about living in the upside down. You know, we really are.
Yes.
We don't have to get out. I don't know. I can't remember how that show ends, but it leads to the question, you know, where do we go from here? Because interestingly, therapists will, if someone is in a narcissistic relationship, they encourage people to go no contact or to withdraw from the relationship. Yep. Is often one of the common solutions. But if you look at the mainstream situation now, it's become so normalized. I mean, how do you extract yourself? You can't fully withdraw. I mean, people are trying to go off grid and live outside of the mainstream.
It's awful. And I don't know the answer to this question, because, you know, I went no contact with my mother. It was necessary. If I hadn't, I was drinking myself to death. I probably would have committed suicide. I was on the cusp in that crisis of committing myself to a psychiatric hospital. It was that severe. And I mean, just, you know, for honesty's sake, I mean, you could see the results of the childhood that my brother and sister and I grew up in written all over our lives. You know, I was an active alcoholic for a couple of decades before I finally stopped slowly killing myself with a bottle. You know, every cliched outcome of the abused childhood can be found in me, my brother, my sister. It can be found in almost any child who comes out of this. I went no contact with my mother, but I can't go no contact with the world. And the thing that stunned
me
and frightened me and motivated me to start speaking about this publicly the way I do is saying, oh my God, I have finally put this hurt, this evil out of my life. And I walk out into the world and I'm right back in my mother's home. We are all of us are living in a version of my childhood home or some other abused child's home. That is our normal world now. And we can't trust professionals, therapists, psychologists. I have a therapist myself, but of his type, he's old school. He's almost 70 years old. He was not schooled in woke. He looks around at his field and says most of it is directly anti-therapeutic. You cannot trust people who call themselves counselor or therapist anymore. We've seen them. They've come out. There's a woman named Leslie Elliott Boyce, who was in psychotherapy training at Antioch College in the United States, who was drummed out of her graduate program because she was questioning whether these were actually therapeutic things to be encouraging people to do. The reversal. Dark is light, bitter is sweet, truth is a lie, up is down, pain is pleasure. That is the animating. When you see a reversal, you know that you're in trouble. And we are in trouble because almost everything has been reversed. The people who say that they are healers are the ones who are hurting us. Look at what the medical industry did in response to COVID. Look what they did with rushing these vaccines. Look what our governments did in many Western countries, either mandating vaccines or allowing huge sectors of the huge portions of the private sector to mandate them, effectively putting government approval behind this. People's businesses were closed. People were locked into their houses. People lost family members and relationships. I lost relationships over this. Many millions of people have.
Agreed. Yeah, we see it every day. I mean,
it was an extraordinary, extraordinary societal scale act of abuse.
Well, it's the last 3-4 years of that abuse that's led me to be interested in this subject, Josh, and it's actually the catalyst for us being here, because a lot of what you've described, I've seen at the root cause of some of the problems that we've been enduring for the last, well, certainly throughout the COVID chapter.
Yeah,
you know, Mateus's explanation of mass formation brought one layer of explanation to all of this.
Yep.
This brings another layer of explanation. You know, Mateus's breakdown of the four factors, you know, when it comes down to social anxiety, yeah, background anxiety, social discontent, lack of meaning and purpose. Is that four? Yeah, that's four. For each of those, you can see a pathway, you know.
Yes.
Managing our own anxiety, finding inner peace, finding purpose, you know, and strengthening our social bonds. And the social discontent is the hardest one to deal with, because that's all interwoven with what we've just talked about here, which makes it the hardest part of the problem. What was fascinating about the way you describe when you recognize, when your sister helped you recognize what was happening with your mother, things started to slot into place. It suddenly made sense, which is why conversations like this, I think, are so important. The Mateus conversation was huge, because for everyone, people went, what the? Now I understand why people followed the masses. And this now also helps hopefully put things into place, because I think one of the greatest challenges is people don't understand. They can see it and they're uncomfortable with it, but you can't talk yes. about it, because if you talk about it, you're going to get full-born, you're not going to get attacked by that emotionalized, intense, narcissistic behavior. And therefore, like, there's no incentive to actually call it for what it is. There's no incentive to raise your voice, even though you can see it's an inversion, because you are going to become a victim of it. And that, for most people, they can't endure, or you know, they're trying to get on with their lives and they don't want to suffer that form of abuse. They don't want to be abused by an abuser. The challenge,
but you can't
avoid it. Like, you're going to get abused anyway if you don't.
You are already being abused.
Exactly.
We are all already being abused. I mean, everyone is situated differently. People have different concerns. People who have the care of children, the responsibility of children, have a different set of concerns that will inform their decisions than someone like me who does not. But we are all already there. There is no avoiding this. And it will end in death and misery. There is no other end to this unless we change, unless we find another path. This will end in misery and then death. And if it's, I can try to encourage people to be braver, to confront this more, to speak more publicly. I know how difficult it is. And I also know people have a lot to lose. And I'm in a position where, you know, I lost most of what I had. I was canceled from my job for speaking out about this. I lost a 20-year career. I'm now unemployable in my sector because I'm morally and socially contaminated now. Many people have had this experience. I lost almost all of my close friendships. there's a lot to lose, but there is yet more to lose. I would ask anybody who, you know, contemplate this for yourself. What do I have to lose? My job, my home, my position in the community, maybe my church, whatever. Yeah, those are all real things. You can lose those. But we can lose bigger things too. We can lose more than that. Maybe not bigger things, but we can lose even more. We can lose our economy. We can lose our society. We can lose our first world standard of living. We can lose our ability to feed ourselves. And these things are going to come if we do not change.
Yeah, Josh, in trying to piece together the solution on this, or the solution, solutions on this, I take some comfort from the fact that I spend a lot of time looking at big trends and big cycles and trying to make sense of why things are happening. And it's no surprise, and I've always had an interest in philosophy, and you read any philosophy book from 2,000 years ago, you can realize it's the same shit, different day. You know, it's like, yep. We're suffering the same form of the human condition over and over again. We're evolving in the sense of our material evolution, you know, and our way to live, you know, more prosperous and healthy lives comparatively. But our human condition, has it really evolved? So when I look at grand social trends, and there's a podcast called The Fall of Civilization, and it chronicles through history all these different collapse of empires. And sadly, what we're discussing here, Josh, now is a common factor at the kind of latter stages at the fall of the empire. All of these perversities that you've described and we're experiencing living this upside down, interestingly, they tend to, not with absolute certainty every time, but they are variables that play out before a new cycle begins, a new empire rises. And that, to a degree, gives me some hope. But your point around misery and death and destruction, unfortunately, they are also common factors in that transition. But it's almost, how far into pain do we need to go before we rebound? Now, on the COVID matters, I would say that there has been a rebound effect and that the culture is beginning to shift. It's at the earlier stages. But this part of the conversation that we're having, it's almost so explosive, so animated that people don't want to go near it. But there is a counter reaction to it. There is a response happening to it. And the response isn't necessarily healthy. There's kind of like there is a comedic element to it, people kind of mocking. But at the end of that, there is people who are suffering, and I'm not sure they're receiving it as humor, mm-hmm. and love and light. So there is a navigation part here. And I haven't yet got to the part in that analysis of history to understand what happens to these social norms when they get destroyed to such a level. But I do find hope that there is a rebound. It's almost like all of life goes in a pendulum, and I just don't know how far the pendulum needs to swing before it.
I don't either, but I you're right that it has to be, every individual has to face a certain level of pain and fear up against a wall in order to change direction significantly. We talk about it. The easy example is we talk of alcoholics and drug addicts who hit rock bottom, or at least that's a phrase that we use in the US. Everybody has to find their own rock bottom. Well, it will find them. It will find you.
I think people have it either an individual, like my experience is, you either have it as an individual level, you have your personal circumstances, or something like COVID happens and it makes you go, that's my line. My line has been crossed.
Yeah.
This is not for me.
And we see, right, you know, we see that what happened with COVID woke, and I hate saying, it's not what happened with COVID, it's what our goddamn government did, what our Western governments did to us, and what we allowed them to do to us. Correct. We allowed this. We are as responsible for the misery and the nightmare and the insanity, the psychosis. This was psychosis, societal psychosis. You listening to this, watching this right now, are as responsible for this as the people who did it to us, because we collectively, generally, we allowed this to happen. We put the mask on. We stood 6 feet apart. We followed the little dotted lines in the grocery store. We agreed to work remotely. We allowed our children's schools to be shut down. We took it, right? Now, that was a lesson that a lot of us needed to learn, that we probably couldn't have learned any other way. Because I don't mean to wholly morally condemn people for this, because We didn't think this was...
My audience are probably listening saying, I did none of those things, Josh, but we've got a very unique audience.
understandably, yeah. Again, I remind everyone, they must supply their own not alls, and they must remember not to personalize, because I don't know you and I'm not talking about you.
Yes.
but, this was the first time for many people that they understood that the people that they had always trusted and thought had their best interests at heart not only were not trustworthy and didn't have their best interests at heart, but actually hated them and have always been exploiting them, did not feel kindly disposed toward them, withdrew their love and protection when you failed to obey quickly enough. This is the abusive parent. This is cluster B. Mm. People needed to experience this, sadly. But worryingly, as we see, you know, we're not exactly the same, but, you know, the US, UK, we are way more similar than we are different. Fully half of our populations still approve of this, or mm-hmm. will say in public that they approve of it, which is just as bad.
Yeah.
So this was not enough for at least half the population, which leaves the question open, what will it take? And oh dear God, will it come to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a frightening prospect. And you just wonder what will happen next that will create the next response. I still maintain that there is hope and optimism. I suppose the challenge is what many of us haven't necessarily realized, even if we've resisted what's been happening, is that we are still being exposed to that trauma on a raw scale, and we can't escape the fact that we'll need to take stock on ourselves. You know, I'm sure, you know, the experiences you've been through, you've had to go through all kinds of self-examination to self-regulate yourself in what
it's never ending. It's never ending. I'm still doing it.
So you compound that as a societal level. You know, we have to realize that we have likely been subconsciously impacted by what's gone on, even if we've stood against it and resisted it. And therefore, it's imperative if we want to build a healthy society moving forward, then the simplest solution begins with ourselves and confronting our own patterns in order to make sure that they're healthily expressed and some of the destructive patterns aren't replicated into the future, because we hold the past, you know, we hold the opportunity to start shaping the future as more and more people, quote unquote, wake up to what's going on. They're asking, what can I do? And it's, to me, that's the simplest answer, is look yourself in the mirror and see, you know, who is the person looking back at you, and how can you be the role model for the change you wish to see in the world? Because, you know, the pain can be a great catalyst, I find, and it's a great transformative catalyst. It can lead to periods of great uncertainty as you navigate that, because you have to understand, well, where have I come from? Where am I going? It can be disorientating, but off the other side of that, when you see the path ahead, wow, I think we have this truly enormous opportunity now for those people who are coming to awareness of all these different mm-hmm. things. They're ready to march to a different beat, a different drum. And I think that is going to be the chipping point that sends the pendulum the other way. We'll be the ones to do it. Not alone. No individual has the power to do that. And if we think we do, then we're already in the cluster personality type.
Yeah.
You know, already it's like, uh-oh, keep looking in the mirror. But what do you think? You know, what can individuals do, you know, to conclude as a kind of message of, you know, constructive forward thinking? What can individuals do to be part of the change they want to see?
I think one of the most important things we can do is to constantly ask ourselves if we are telling the truth to ourselves and to other people. Are we telling the truth about ourselves to ourselves? Do we truly understand our motivations? Do we know why we're making the choices we're making, or are we lying to ourselves to make it more emotionally palatable? Are we going along with a program that we know is destructive and is untrue because it is too upsetting to think of being the sore thumb who sticks out and says, no, I won't do that? These are hard things to do. They're very hard. And especially if there are people watching or listening who have experienced any of the things like what I experienced in childhood, undoubtedly there will be. Maybe they experienced them in an abusive marriage, but childhood really sets the template. Many of them will know that, like me, they became part of the problem, and maybe they were part of the problem for a very long time. it's easy to see how it happens. It's hard. It's hard to admit that you were part of the problem. I have an endless well of regret and remorse for many of the ways I lived my life for a long time. That's difficult, and people will find it emotionally difficult. And I'm still reckoning with it. I'll probably reckon with it and try to correct it for the rest of my life. It's hard emotional work, but it is necessary, because if you don't tell the truth to yourself about your own motivations, you will not be able to understand the motivations of other people around you, and you will not be able to make good choices about the people to trust and the people to keep at arm's length. And we need to be able to discern people. We need to know who the wolf is. And just as importantly, we need to know who is not the wolf, mm-hmm. right? Part of being misguided in this way as a result of trauma and unresolved trauma is believing that the people who are hurting you are the ones who love you, and the people who are genuinely safe and trying to help you are your enemies. You reverse. I reversed. We have to get that clear.
I totally agree. I mean, it's a very tricky position to be in, because almost, you know, disaffected is a great term, because people become disaffected by what's going on, and culturally, politically, economically.
Yes.
And as a result, you know, the things they once trusted, institutions, individuals, media, politicians, politics, all of a sudden they no longer trust them. But that lack of trust can become pervasive. Where does healthy skepticism become unhealthy distrust? And as a result, people are now looking people who are driving positive change, and they're looking, you know, understand the skepticism now, but it's almost like they've lost trust in themselves at a deeper level, because they...
Yes, we have. And why wouldn't we?
Yeah, because you didn't originally, you know, until you have that point of recognition, you suddenly realize that you didn't see what was already there in front of you. And it's...
Yes.
There can be some sort of self-blame around all of those things, but actually we can't control what went before us. You know, we can't change it, but what we can change the meaning, I think. We can change the meaning that it has to become empowering for our future and for the things we do today. And I think that's the important solution here, is that we ground ourselves so that we don't become disorientated, because it's easy to get so disorientated with all the madness happening in the world. We come back to ourselves, and your point around finding that truth, you know, and removing, in a way, we can't remove ourselves completely from society, but it's actually removing ourselves from the noise and the distractions and coming back to that point of just self-understanding so that we can orientate the present moment. And keep checking back in, because the moment you walk outside, you know, something's trying to manipulate you, whether it's the advertising board or social media, you know, it's those things are already there. But there's a point, that point of awakening is an interesting one, because you never see the world the same again. So there's no going back. You cross the threshold. And I think that's, again, a mess to me is inspiring, because more and more people are crossing that threshold. But it's now that difficult point, you know. If you've been to a personal development seminar to work on any limiting beliefs that you may have had from childhood, and you re-engineer them to be more empowering, that's usually a guided process. There's a support mechanism. When your belief about the world, your global views are flipped upside down during a period of enormous turbulence like today, there's not necessarily the guardrails to help you orientate these times. So we need to club together. We need to, you know, help each other on this journey so that we can orientate in this confusing, upside down, crazy, mad world that we're in, so that we can bring our own sense of sanity to the moment, and hopefully become sanity becomes contagious. You know, let's make truth contagious. You know, it's yeah, how we do that, I don't know, but you know, the noble pursuit, I guess, Josh, I don't know. So any closing words to wrap us up for today? You know, you've demonstrated enormous courage. You've started a podcast to talk about all these things. You know, you're still on your own journey with all this, and, you know, plowing ahead. Do you have any kind of words of wisdom that you'd like to impart for anyone that's kind of feeling disorientated by the state of reality, and how they can come back to, you know, are there things that you practice that bring you back to a sense of inner truth?
I'm no sage. I don't have any. I'm not qualified to. I'm not. I'm no spiritual leader. I'm not. I'm not a guru. I'm not any of those things. I would say that try to hold open the possibility. I will tell people something that my therapist told to me when I asked a question like this, and it has turned out to be true. I once asked him, when I was trying to figure out what was the difference between my mother and me, in that my mother could not or did not ever make progress in resolving her childhood trauma that made her into the person she was. She never saw it. She never started to see the truth. What is different between a person like that and a person like me, as highly imperfect as I am, being able to make any progress in getting past living in that trauma? And he said, the ability to understand, accept, and tolerate that everything or almost everything you were taught and believed about the world was wrong. And it's a tall order. But I can tell you from personal experience, it's true. Almost everything I believed about the world and about human nature was wrong. It was reversed. I was in fundamental emotional and logical error about huge parts of life. And I can say, having been through that, it is not pleasant. That acknowledgement is not pleasant. It's not fun. It's frightening. But you will survive it. You can survive it. And you will see more clearly on the other side. So try to be open to that.
So it reminds me of I know it's been heavily politicized now, but it reminds me of the scene from Matrix where it's like you take the red pill and you have to suffer the burden of all that truth.
Yes.
And yeah, that creates discomfort. But ultimately, you get to live in reality, or you can go back to sleep on the blue pill and just suffer the consequences anyway, you know. So it's a tall order, but that's, you know, we talk about it all the time on the show, that freedom comes with responsibility. And
you know, it's, we have been societally traumatized severely. We have been abused. We have had the rug pulled out from under every fundamental assumption we had about the society that we lived in and the people around us. We saw people for who they really are for the first time in many cases, and what we saw was horrifying. Sometimes we saw parts of ourselves, I certainly did, that were horrifying. This has left a mark. It's left a mark on all of us who've been through it, that we will carry for the rest of our lives. We can make of it what we will. But we have been damaged by this. And at some point, in some form or many forms, I think we're going to have to talk about what we do as a traumatized society. Because although it is not exactly the same, right? I understand this, and I'm not trying to compare real extremity to lesser extremity. But societies that go through war are traumatized. Europe was traumatized by World War II. And it's not my idea first, but there's a pretty good hypothesis out there that World War II had a lot to do with the rise in cluster B personality disorders and transmission of these values to children. And something similar happened to us. Now, of course, in the United States, even in World War II, we fared much, much better than England did, than any European country did. The only attack on our land was Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. We didn't have the Blitz. Our rationing was not as severe. And in the societal response to COVID, of course, most of us didn't actually starve. And our homes weren't bombed, but the foundational things were taken away from us. Freedom to speak, even within our own families, freedom to make medical decisions, freedom to work. It was all taken.
Yeah, Boris Johnson literally called it, you know, talked about being on a war footing. So that parallel to me is incredibly relevant. And even today when I host events, 4 years on, it's still a cathartic experience for people, because my audience is all very much about this topic of COVID, you know, that we did 1,000 episodes. We dissected it from every angle. We were nonstop challenging. We were one of the first, and, you know, finally people did catch on. But now today,
thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.
No, really. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's been nonstop. You know, I've gone all in. It's become a calling. I've left my previous life behind. But when we host events now, people are still having these discussions, sharing their experience, what happened to them during the last few years. You know, it's cathartic for them. So people are through conversation processing the trauma, but it's unguided, it's unstructured, and it's you know, whether you were part of what was going on and complying with things or not, whether you were resisting it, either way, you know, society as a whole has been through a traumatic experience. And you're right, my fear off the back of it, and is it in the way we describe World War II, is we could experience the same. And I think we are experiencing the same. And I think the political elections, you know, when Trump got elected last time, that's put the whole thing on steroids. And if he's back in again, I think we're going to go.
It's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. And Dan, I got to tell you, 2016 was the year that all this happened for me with my mother. But I, you know, people don't change overnight. And I was still a leftist at that point. And I'm afraid that I was one of those people that thought Trump was the great Satan and the great devil. I was extremely upset about his election. I nattered on thousands of words on Facebook and other platforms about what a horrible, evil, destructive, you know, da 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 da. Now,
I
think he's a narcissist.
I'm not
a fan of Trump either, but I'm at the point now where I say, if he is the better alternative, then he is going to get my vote. I have to work with what I have.
Well, this is the problem. Like, at the time, I was like, we've got Trump or Clinton or Trump or Biden, Boris Johnson. It's like, are these the best people in the world to be leading some of the biggest, you know, the most important economy? What happened?
Now, what happened was the veil came off of us. We saw clearly. For the first time. And, you know, I think the reality of it is, you know, Trump is who he is. We can all see that he's egotistical, shallow, vain, but in my view, my mistake was extrapolating that into the hysteria that we still see. He may be all of those things, but he is not a dictator. He is not, his policies, many of them, the ones that were actually enacted, were quite sensible, did good things for the economy, did good things for employment law. You know,
I mean, people say that there wouldn't have been half of these conflicts in Ukraine and Russia and Gaza if Trump had been in. And to an extent, I can see why that may be the case. You know, his foreign policy was, for all his swagger, you know, he's not a warmonger. You know, he might talk the talk at times, but
we're also going to have to, as a society, we're going to have a conversation, and we're going to have to reckon with what really happened during COVID. And we're not there yet. Only about half of my country is there yet. And that's not enough. We're going to have a real reckoning about what happened, and it's going to be difficult. As deluded as I was 7 years ago when I first started this changing direction in my life, I had learned enough from my experience waking up to who my mother was, understanding that what personality disorders were and how very severe pathological narcissism really was. I'd learned enough that when COVID came along, I would have called myself a woke liberal. I was a woke liberal. I was a screaming leftist. I'm not anymore. I would say I'm a conservative now.
I'm just eternally politically homeless. That's how I describe myself.
Well, there's that too. I didn't join the Republican Party. I didn't sign up to go be the complete opposite. Although the majority of my political views are the opposite of what they used to be. Mm-hmm. I am not a Republican. I'm not a capital C conservative. I happen to find that what I believe is morally right and virtuous and wise tends to get grouped now under what people consider conservative. Yes. So that's the best I can say about that. But I didn't fall for COVID for more than about a week and a half. And I'm not saying that as like that, that's not because I have some great inner strength. It's not, it's just the circumstances of my life had led me to a place where I simply could not, but I saw through it very, very early. And I looked around in astonishment and horror at how easily people were swayed by this stuff, you know. And I also had some insight that came from my job before I was canceled. I was the director, the executive of a nonprofit campaigning group whose mission was to help educate people and protect them from being overcharged in the funeral and burial transaction, because that could be a very big problem. In the States, the funeral and burial industry is more than $20 billion a year here. There's a lot of room for financial exploitation of the grieving. So that was my expertise that I did for 20 years. And so I knew that when when the media started putting these stories out of, oh my God, there are refrigerated morgue trucks in California, people were treating this as, they were emotionally reacting to it as if it were literally a sign of the zombie apocalypse.
Yes.
That society was falling apart. There were corpses piling up in the streets. And I knew that none of it was real, because I knew from my experience professionally that there are refrigerated morgue trucks all over the place all the time that you don't know about because no one's talking about them. Yeah. Every time a crematory gets too busy, if there's a spike in flu deaths, they're going to hire a refrigerated morgue truck because they only have 6 slots in their inside refrigerator. This happens all the time. There was nothing different about this except a spike in deaths in certain locations. And to my mind now, I think you know far, far more about this than I do. But to my mind, I think a lot of these spikes in deaths, to the degree that that wasn't actually a lie, because a lot of it was a lie. A lot of death certificates were coded with COVID that had nothing to do with COVID. But to the extent that there were excess deaths, a lot of them appeared to have come from the way that we actually treated people in hospital rather than from COVID itself.
Absolutely.
This stuff was all, I looked around this and I have never felt more disconnected and odd man out from the rest of society as I did back then, because I said, no one will believe me. It doesn't matter what I say, they're not going to believe me. And they didn't.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, people were saying the hospitals were overflowing and full. But they weren't.
Were they in your area?
No, because you
could
actually.
The claim was there, but they were not.
You could download the data that showed the actual capacity. And then there's a publication that serves the medical industry here in the UK, a journal. And they were publishing, you know, they're literally like, they've dropped 60% of their capacity. So they're operating at 40% max. And then you'd get people like literally walking into hospitals with their mobile phone going, all right, then where is everyone? And those people would get arrested. They would get arrested for going into a hospital and filming the empty wards because they were destroying the narrative, you know. Yeah, but people wouldn't see that for what it was. It was impossible. You know, I would share, I'd pull up spreadsheets on my broadcast, say, here, look, here's the hospital that's just been in the news. Let's look at their numbers for the last 10 weeks. And it's just like, it was just like their lens, their ability, people's ability to see that through it was just not there. But we've discussed it at length, actually. It's difficult to square up because what we've just been talking around now, around this kind of collective trauma and their ability to, you know, their proclivity to kind of almost fall into these traps. We have also seen the opposite, where certain traumas or certain personal experiences were more likely to lead to people being awake to what was going on, that they almost immediately understood the relationship between themselves and the state because they'd experienced it themselves on a personal level before.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of people that did not have that connection to make. They didn't have that, you know.
I think there's probably a difference between recognized trauma, because your point of understanding of the trauma that you've been through with your mother, you'd been through an understanding. It became a consciously, you had a conscious awareness around
it. Was it. Conscious, yes.
Whereas I think a lot of people may have had that type of traumatic relationship, but they haven't had that moment of realization yet.
Dan, so before I had that moment, before I stopped lying to myself and to everybody else, I said things. This is a literal statement out of my mouth. I remember saying it 20 years ago to a friend who was trying to tell me 20 years ago, Josh, your mother is exploiting you. Your mother is exploiting you. You don't have to tolerate this. You don't have to do what she says. And my visceral, emotional, hateful reaction to my friend was to scream, my mother is a saint. I did a complete reversal. There are many people who are out there like that right now.
It's a defense mechanism.
It's too painful. It's too painful. Let me not say never. That's part of old me. I have a difficult time imagining that I will experience anything as painful as the realization of the truth. And the truth is that my mother did not love her children because she is not capable of loving. She is broken in a way that makes her incapable. I did not have a mother who loved me. And that was my greatest fear. It haunted my nightmares my entire life. If I had listened to my dreams, I would have known the truth many years before because my subconscious was telling me the truth. It is so painful. And unfortunately, a lot of people are going to have an experience at that level of painful realization. And I don't often know what to say about it because part of me says I don't wish pain on people, and a part of me does wish for that realization.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know? Pain is the greatest motivator. And you can go to a talk where someone tells their own kind of woe to win story, where they've gone through this traumatic period and they've transformed it into something positive, but until you've actually experienced that viscerally yourself, it's very difficult. Which is why people live in the comfort zone. They can stay in a job they hate, a relationship that makes them unhappy, but it never reaches the point where it crosses a line. Therefore, they stay in this like comfortable numbness, which is dreadfully saddening, but it's a hard reality that until you get that point of leverage, until you cross the line, you cross the threshold, that's it. Never again, never, no more, you know. I do think once people get to a point of awareness, I think they can mentally take themselves there without physically getting to that point of desperation. I think you can amplify in your mind, if I stay in this relationship or I continue in this job, 5 years, 10 years down the line, you're suddenly like, well, where will my life go? Like, I think you can almost like project into the future and go,
yeah,
no. But it even then, when does it get people to cross the line? I don't know, because it's still like, well, it could.
It's different for everybody. Thank you for having me today. Thank you for giving me the time. I have to get ready for another obligation myself. Let me ask you this. I know how busy you must be. I'm not asking for an answer right now, but if you would consider making time at some point to come on my show and give maybe a COVID post-mortem from your perspective. I would really like my audience to hear what you have to say. You have been on this beat in such an in-depth way, far, far beyond anything I have done. And maybe I'd like to have a conversation about what you learned, what you saw, and maybe bring in some of that about what do we do about our collective societal traumatization. So if at any point you have the time to do that, I'd be very grateful. So let me know if you can.
Very honored to do that. And it's a conversation that we're actually, you know, I've been thinking about now, is how do we almost do a retrospective of what's just happened so that we can really underscore the lessons. So that'd be,
I'd like to talk about that with you in front of other people.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah, amazing.
Okay.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your show, where people can find it, and what they can expect when they come to listen to the conversations you're having around all of these things?
Sure. The show is called Disaffected. The podcast is called Disaffected. It's weekly. We may be adding more. Airs at 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on Rumble on Saturdays, and then at 9 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on YouTube. It's about an hour long. It's a one-man talk show. My partner and producer, my business partner, producer, Kevin, and I make the show together. And we talk about current issues through a psychological lens. And we've devoted a lot of time to analyzing the sorts of things that you and I have talked about here on the show. But we also have fun, too. I mean, this has been sort of a serious conversation. But I like to cut up and have fun. And I like to make fun of perverse perversities and absurdities in societies. So, you know, I think you come if you want a few laughs as well. I also run a consulting service, private coaching for people if they want to talk about these issues in a family, social or work or academic context. And they can find me at joshuaslocum.net.
Amazing. Thank you, Josh. And thank you for all the work you're
doing.
Dan,
thank you.
To raise attention for these
issues.
Thank
you for having these conversations out in public.
Thank you. I mean, my team are reminding me it's important that we bring a bit of laughter to these conversations. So that's my
new resolution. It's not always possible.
Yeah. but yeah, that's my new resolution. So you can go and get a dose of that on Josh's show. So do go check that out. Thank you so much for being here with us.
And thank you.
For anyone at home, you know, serious note, you know, if you feel affected by what's going on in the world right now and you don't know where to turn, then Josh's podcast and his services may well be a route for you. But just hopefully this conversation has made you recognize that you're far from alone. And often some of that burden can be lifted when we recognize that. So here's to a bright future, Josh. It's in our hands.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate you.